Hello?
I'm Nancy Miller. I'm with the Aging and Public Health section of APHA, and I'm really happy to be moderating or co-moderating the session with Steve Kay with the Disability section. This session, again, is related to the Americans with Disabilities Act, which we all know celebrated its 20th anniversary earlier this summer. And the session is focused on triumphs, defeats, and unfinished business of disability policy. So I'm happy, as a representative of the Aging and Public Health section, to be sponsoring this with the Disability section. Our section members have collaborated in many previous meetings on joint sessions related to disability policy, and our relatively new change reflects our increasing interest in examining issues related to aging, disability, and long-term care issues, and particularly across a much broader kind of life range. So I'm happy to be here. I should say that I have to leave somewhere in the middle or so of this session because I have another paper to present, but I'm looking forward to hearing from representatives this afternoon and then the discussion that I'm able to stay for tonight.
And I'm Steve Kay, Program Chair of the Disability section. Looks like all of you know that already. let me introduce the panelists. Sitting next to Nancy is Jessica Lehman, who is the lead community organizer at Community Resources for Independent Living, which is an independent living center in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's in Hayward, California. And Jessica is, if I may say so, known throughout the state as a kind of superstar community organizer. And I have to say I'm very impressed with her ability to get ordinary people with disabilities kind of motivated and mobilized to change things in their communities and to make policy, to advocate for policy change. Sitting next to Jessica is Hillary Jorgensen, who is one of the founders of the National Youth Leadership Network, and she has she's a lawyer and has a JD from University of Seattle, did you say?
Yeah.
Seattle University, and she is the director of Colorado, okay, now I have to look it up, of Colorado Progressive Action, where she works on healthcare reform issues and immigration issues. And sitting next to me is Mitch LaPlante, who is a disability researcher at the University of California, San Francisco. He's a professor and is sometimes known as the father of disability statistics. He is the co-director of the UCSF Disability Statistics Center and the co-principal investigator of the Center for Personal Assistance Services at UCSF. And I thought, why don't we go in order of the way people are seated. Jessica's shaking her head. Don't start with me. Is that right? Okay. So Jessica will start. I asked people to speak for something like 10 minutes. I kind of been envisioning this section as kind of a free-for-all, but I thought people might as well give kind of opening remarks. Oh, and I forgot to say that there are five panelists listed on the program, and Stephen Gilson and Liz DePoy, who work together and are also married to each other, were going to present, and they have, as a result of a family emergency, they've had to leave early. Which very much to their regret, very much to my regret too, because I really wanted them to be here. And they wrote up a kind of one-page summary of what they would have said for me to read. And I said, well, I'm not going to defend your position, though. And they said, oh, you really should. So I don't think I'll be able to do that. But so that's why they're not here. After the three speakers speak, I will do that. So go ahead, Jessica.
Seems very far away. People sort of jump to thinking, oh, you know, the sky is not falling.
relevant to the average person with a disability, but I think actually is, and that's genetic technologies. And I think the major changes happening right now in genetic technologies really threaten to radically affect the population of people with certain disabilities, to radically decrease the population, and to really change the way that we all think about disability. So it definitely affects all of us, and particularly I want to talk about the dramatic growth of prenatal genetic testing and a little bit on stem cell testing. So of course in this country we have a history of eugenics, of people being involuntarily sterilized, and the eugenics movement really declaring who should reproduce and who should not. So now already we're seeing a concrete impact of prenatal testing. Dr. Brian Stocko of Children's Hospital of Austin found that there were 49% fewer babies born with Down syndrome in the U.S. between 1989 and 2005 than would be expected, and presumably that's based on increased rates of amniocentesis and then abortion if somebody finds out that a fetus would have Down syndrome. So in approach choice equality, we really have to look at how do we make sure that people have true choices. When somebody is pregnant, it's often assumed that she would be tested, and there are lots of stories of doctors saying, well, you know, this is just standard, I'll sign you up for this test. It doesn't hurt to know. Why not? And I think we're seeing that maybe it does hurt to know, that maybe people don't want to have that information and be forced to make choices that they don't necessarily want to make. And there's actually some evidence. There's a study of parents of children with genetic disabilities have often chosen not to undergo testing with subsequent pregnancies. And we certainly have horror stories of, you know, mothers of kids with Down syndrome where people say, what happened? Did you have amnio? And these stories may not be everyone, but I think the existence of them at all says we really have a problem that we need to consider. So we definitely need to find ways to educate people about the experience of having a disability, about having a child with a disability. And to some degree, these are things that we're always trying to do, right, is to change the way society thinks of disability. And all of us in this work, and probably all of us in this room, know that that's a long journey, that unfortunately we're far away from, although I think we've made important strides in the past decades. But with genetic technologies, we're in a situation where we're not afforded that time that we've had to say, okay, we're gradually getting there, and hopefully someday people will see disability for a positive and negative thing, you know, a natural way of being. But right now people are making decisions about whether or not to have children and what to tell other people and how to treat medical professions based on how they see disability. So we have to find a way to jump in and educate people maybe a little more quickly than we've been thinking about maybe in different settings. So as far as what choices people have, we need to make sure that people can choose whether or not to test, whether or not to abort, whether or not to keep and raise a child with a disability. And then of course that means having the resources that are needed to raise a child with a disability, financial and technological and all sorts of resources. So I think one of the dangers, not only in ending up with fewer kids with disabilities born, but are these assumptions that people would want to have a kid with a disability, and really reinforcing the idea that disability is something to be avoided, prevented, eliminated, and, you know, often at all costs. There's also the question about what about when people want to have a child with a disability. So often we're talking about non-disabled parents or people that don't have a lot of experience with a disability. They want to test, they want to figure out, you know, how can I make sure that my kid is so-called healthy, right? But what about those parents who have dwarfism or deaf parents who say, we want a kid like us, we want a kid that's going to fit into our culture because we think it's a wonderful culture and a wonderful way of being. And then they're attacked for, you know, inflicting something on their child in other people's eyes. So I think we also see the same issues with stem cell testing, where people with disabilities have really different views on cure, where some people say, yes, I want to be able to walk again, I want to be able to do whatever it is that I used to do before I had a disability. And there are certainly others that say, no, I'm perfectly fine the way I am. I want the focus to be on being proud of who we are as people with disabilities and not on needing to be cured. And I think we have to find a way to be fine with having those different viewpoints, but make sure that the rest of society sees that cure isn't the only way, isn't the inevitable choice. Otherwise, I think we again really risk confirming people's idea that everyone with a disability is miserable and the only way out is to try to prevent or eliminate or cure disability. kind of started to figure out how to wrap our heads around it and what the heck do we do about it. But we first need to make it clear what's wrong with this message that society is putting out there about genetic technologies and disability. We need to find ways to educate people about what disability really means, about what their options are. And I think we also need to work with the broader social justice movement to look at how do we get across to people the importance of the diversity that disability and so many other characteristics have to our society. So I was saying genetic technology certainly doesn't feel urgent, like employment, like deinstitutionalization, like so many other issues we're facing. And I actually think that even those issues are getting pushed aside or will be pushed aside in the next few years with some of the basic threats that the disability community is facing to a lot of the very basic programs that we've won over the past few years and decades. So in terms of Medicaid, SSI, personal assistance services, I'm from California, and in the past two years, we've lost dental care, we've lost podiatry, other basic health services. We've cut the state supplement to SSI, so that now the SSI grant in California is basically less than the cost of a studio, the 1 month's rent for a studio apartment, so we're not leaving people any options. We've also cut our hours to personal assistance services, and governments threaten to eliminate personal assistance services altogether, to eliminate early medical equipment, to eliminate occupational and physical therapy. We've had huge threats before us, and obviously those can't be avoided. They can't be ignored. We have to address them. So in California, we formed a very strong coalition with independent living centers, with health advocates, with senior groups, with childcare advocates, all kinds of low-income groups coming together and saying this isn't about pitting one program versus another. This is about what kind of society do we want to live in, and how do we make sure that everyone has the basic services and programs that they need to survive. And we fought long and hard, and we keep fighting for new revenues instead of cuts. So we've had some success. We've held off the worst of those proposed cuts. But the reality is where we are now is that corporations are still getting tax breaks. We still don't have a tax on oil companies, drilling for oil in California. So next year, we're not going to have any more money there than we did this year. And we're going to have all these potential cuts on the table again. So while we're fighting this state by state, we of course need to further change the way our society thinks about programs that support people with disabilities, that support seniors, that support poor people, that instead of being a drain on the system, it's better and cheaper than the alternatives, right? Nursing homes, prisons, streets, and hospitals. So I guess in summing up, we really need to continue to fight for everyday survival while also finding a way, finding some capacity to deal with these other issues like genetic technologies. We have to make sure that our community speaks up before our lives are decided for us.
Thank you. Hi, it's great to be here today. Welcome to my beautiful hometown. I think it's about 57. So you will have experienced the sunny Colorado and the snowy Colorado. And if you don't like the weather, you know, wait a few hours and it'll be something different. Then I was asked to sit on this panel today and speak to the meeting on maybe to talk about disability policy. I haven't been mad. That's a really, really, really big topic. Like Jessica said, I think we can sit here for the next week and talk about disability policy. But so I decided to focus on what I really see is the way we look at disability policy, both in this social justice policy or other social justice policy. As Steve mentioned, I work on a lot of different issues, not just disability-specific issues. And I really believe that we do our community and our movement a disservice when we focus solely on the disability aspect of policy. Because I am not just non-identity. I am disabled, I am living, I am gay, and from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. and day from 10 a.m. to noon. Like, it just doesn't work that way. And so I would really like to challenge us to start thinking about the way we talk about disability issues and disability policies. Because there's almost not one single issue out there that is specifically a disability issue. I worked on political film for a long time before I returned often, and political film is a disability issue, it's a racial justice issue, it's an economic justice issue, and looking at issues in silence simply, in my opinion, does not work. We are not non-single identity, many of us share multiple identities, and to look at solutions that only focus on one aspect of the person's identity isn't good policy to me. Policy should be made with everybody in mind, not just one community or one identity. And so I really wanted to start off my remarks by sort of challenging us to think about ways in which maybe as a community and as a movement we can engage in policy that's not just disability specific. And so, you know, with that, I sort of wanted to talk about, one of the questions that Steve had posed is, where in the future, do you see disability policy? And in the future, I don't see policy that's specifically disability policy. I see policy that works for everyone. I worked a lot on Medicare and Medicare with them. And that's, just to focus on certain aspects of that, not only justice to everyone, a law that big should include immigrants. It should include people with disabilities. It should include people on the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, especially in the intersex community. It should include low-income community. It should include community of color, and those kinds of things. So, I really look forward to engaging in a conversation with other youth about ways in which we can get out of our silos and get out of thinking about issues in only one way, from only one community's perspective. I think that our movement, the disability movement specifically, and the social justice movement more generally, has a lot to gain from starting to think about policy outcomes and gains in a way that's far more holistic and far kinder to the people that policy is going to eventually affect. So thank you, and I look forward to engaging in our conversation with you.
So,
no, go first, but use that microphone instead, see if that works well. Use the other microphone.
Turn that off. Well,
how's the sound on that? Talk.
Can you hear me?
Okay.
I've been using the assisted listening device in this room for the past couple of days, so I want to make sure you can all hear me. So I wanted to talk about the intersection that I've had in terms of disability policy. And let me just say that my interest in this is personal assistance services and long-term services and supports, but I am interested in this from a cross-disability, cross-age, cross-population way which I think is important because we all need PAS, we'll all need PAS at some point in our lives, and we all have family members and friends and people we know who need PAS. And Jessica had mentioned some aspects of this, but I just want to talk about a few of the specifics, because I think my reason for being at the table here is because I listened to people in the disability community who needed some help with passing some legislation, which is the Community Choice Act, Senator Harkin's bill, that would provide a level of long-term services and supports for everyone in the United States, whereas if you heard our earlier session before lunch on PAS, there are many people who don't have access to long-term services and supports. Kind of depends on what state you're in and how generous your state is. So the short of it is that Senator Harkin wanted to pass this act, and the Congressional Budget Office said, this is going to be too expensive. This is a costly entitlement that states won't be able to control. And it became, the CBO score became the albatross around the bill's neck. But ADAPT didn't believe it, and I didn't believe it. And I listened to ADAPT, and I and my colleagues and Steve Kay started to do some estimates of what the legislation would cost. And we got a paper published on this, and we showed that our estimate was a tenth of what the Congressional Budget Office said the legislation would cost. And the reason for that is it's legislation that is targeted to people who have a level of need that's high enough to go into an institution, and the Congressional Budget Office grossly overestimated what that population would be. So it's really a story of cost effectiveness, which is what Washington pays attention to. And because of that, I was invited to testify before the Senate Finance Committee and told the committee members and Max Baucus that the CBO, you know, basically just overestimated this by a large order of magnitude. And that was heard, and Baucus said that he would ask the CBO to score the bill again. And then came health care reform, and Senator Harkin tried to fold the Community Choice Act into the health reform legislation. And I tried to help with that effort. I and my colleagues met with Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services actuaries and Congressional Budget Office actuaries to look again at what this act would cost. And the nice thing is that they used our paper to generate their estimates, but at the same time, our paper, while it showed that the cost was pretty low with inflation and looking at a 10-year window for healthcare reform, their estimate was that it would be $8 billion a year, and anything over $2 billion couldn't be included in the bill. So instead, the Community Choice Act became the community first choice option. And instead of mandating all the states to do this, what was included was an option for the states to include Community Choice Act as an option. And they would get, the states would get an extra 6% federal matching rate if they choose to do this. So I'm kind of reacting to what Steve asked us as panelists, but also what the title of the presentation is. So this is something of both a triumph and a defeat, in my opinion. And I would say that if we didn't have the chance to work with ADAPT or at the urging of ADAPT to develop our cost estimates, that the community first choice option probably wouldn't be in healthcare reform now. So that was a collaboration between researchers and advocates in the sense that it was a political collaboration. We needed to do the research, but the advocates needed to have the research in order to push forward their agenda. So that was pretty much a cost-effectiveness consideration. And then Jessica mentioned what's been going on in California, where our dear governor wanted to cut out the entire in-home services and supports program. And I thought I'd say a little bit about that, because that is also an area where research is pushing back on what the politicians have tried to get away with. So the short of it is, I was invited to be a, we've done some research on unmet need and adverse consequences, so, which basically shows that when you need help with things like bathing and dressing and eating, and you don't get help, you are at risk of adverse consequences, and these things are costly, and the state wasn't paying any attention to that. They just wanted to cut services. And so as a result of being part of the legislative process, I made the argument that, well, the state shouldn't be able to do that without proving that beyond any, you know, reasonable doubt, by cutting these services, they weren't going to increase hospitalizations and increase people falling and losing weight unintentionally and all these bad things. So that argument was heard in the courts, and a federal judge issued an injunction against the cutting of the in-home services and supports program. And then, so that was partly an issue of cost effectiveness, but I think it was partly also an issue of looking at it in terms of the whether it's the right thing to do. And so what I wanted to say is that I think we're at the limit of perhaps what we can argue for in terms of cost effectiveness. Cost effectiveness is looked at very narrowly through the lens of diverting people from institutions, and even the Olmsted Act sort of recognizes the right of individuals to live in the least restrictive setting in the community. But it doesn't recognize the right of people to live freely and live as free agents and do the things that other people do in the community, which includes things like going to school or going to work. And so I believe we have to get beyond Olmsted. I particularly like the language of the United Nations Convention, which the United States is a signatory to, but we need to have ratified by the Senate. And that provides a clear statement of what I'm talking about. Well, what I'm talking about is based on this, so I get the inspiration from this. And it asserts the right to personal assistance services, so that individuals are not segregated or isolated in the community, and so that they may make decisions to participate in society as others do. And I just invite you all to reflect on that statement, because I think it expresses well the idea of freedom. And I used to think, well, ADAPT will come into the meeting or in front of the senator's office and say, we want to pass the Community Choice Act. And then they'd say, free our people. And this is what they're talking about. And I came finally to understand that this is exactly what people with ADAPT are talking about. It's not just where you can live, it's how you can live. And I like to use an example. Some people, it works for some people, maybe not for others, but, you know, individuals, everybody needs the right, everybody should enjoy the right to do what other people, to choose to do what other people can freely choose to do. And so when everybody in San Francisco is going to see the Giants, I don't believe it's fair for someone not to be able to go to the Giants game because they lack an attendant. Now, how we finance that, how we organize that, I'll just point out that the UN Convention says that people have the right to access personal assistance services. So it's not right that you don't have access to PAS so that you can do the things that you want to do that other people can freely choose to do. But it also doesn't say that you need to have every hour of your PAS paid for by the federal government either. So I think therein lies the challenge for the future. And in terms of next steps, what we can do over the next few years, you know, we can still pass the Community Choice Act. Just because it's included as an option doesn't mean that it can't be passed as a law, and people would have the right to PAS, at least, you know, at a certain level of need throughout the country, regardless of where people live. That's not the way it is now. We need to press for the Senate and the administration to make good on its promise to ratify the United Nations Convention. And we need to pursue all the options that are available to us under healthcare reform, including community first choice option and some of the other options that are available for long-term services and supports, even though there's still options. And we need to also encourage people to participate in the CLASS Act, because I'm afraid that with this tie to the right, people are going to be encouraged not to participate in it. And I can just envision a campaign to try to get people not to participate in this social insurance program that for once will provide people an opportunity to work and to buy into an insurance program that will pay for their long-term care needs later on. And since legal options are so useful, let's not forget those. We still need to pursue lawsuits under Olmstead and class action suits, which is what prevented the governor from cutting these programs in California. And continue to push back, because there is no right to PAS right now in our country. And we need to establish that right, and we need to push back on the states that are, and other entities that are trying to take these services away from.
Hearing what I've heard, especially from Hillary, I'm now actually quite disappointed. I was already very disappointed that the that Stephen and Liz couldn't be here, but I think they would have really liked this panel. So here is what they gave me to read out to you. They start by saying their major point is, quote, "We support human rights and full participation, but rather in this argument are opposing the methods that have been enacted to ostensibly reach these goals, which we see as barriers to that aim." And the first section is called Support and Quandaries for This Argument. Number one, we fully acknowledge the exclusion and discrimination encountered on the basis of embodied illness and difference. Notice they don't say disability. Two, we question why the method of compliance legislation was the primary approach selected to change social and personal attitudes, social perception, and stereotype. Three, thoughts cannot be legislated. Morality cannot be legislated. Action, to an extent, can be legislated, but only minimal action. Why were other methods not created to address inequity? Four, the presence of specialized legislation is segregating. Such legislation says, you are not one of us. You do not have the same rights that others have under human rights and resource laws. We can decide for you, and we can include you or not include you. And they're often referring to Tchaikovsky's work. Tchaikovsky's work on inclusion or as inclusion as exclusion highlights this point. Point five. The legislation that has been enacted provides eviscerated human rights, trumped and often nullified by fiscal utilitarian arguments or non-enforceability. Point six, which has several subpoints, and I won't read out each of this. I will read them, but I won't letter them. Although there have been some important initial outcomes from this legislation, a civil society should not be satisfied with them on several fronts. Specialized legislation has only created mandates that may or may not invoked. We see this legislation as grand narrative. It does no work and obfuscates its maintenance of the status quo of inequality on the basis of assumed embodied incapacity and costly maintenance. Specialized legislation does not cover the universe of human rights under which others live. Specialized legislation only applies to those who qualify. What happens to those who do not, but who still experience discrimination? Qualification is vague and based on diagnostic pedigree. Who else would be satisfied with reasonable accommodations over full access? Who else would be satisfied with limited options when compared to those available to others? Specialized legislation derails the fundamental progress toward human rights for all. And point seven, why would we want to continue more of what has not produced the outcomes of equal opportunity and access to resources rather than rethink approaches? And in the section marked quandaries, there are 2 points. Number one, who changes what, when, who is sacrificed during change, who suffers more as a result of change? And point two, if membership in a population provides specialized benefits such as mobility devices covered with someone else's money, in other words, wheelchairs, what is relinquished to obtain these benefits? What is lost from innovation and the production of affordable commercial equipment for everyone to choose? What happens to one's capacity to earn? How is poverty obfuscated by attention to surface essentialist characteristics? And finally, there are 2 suggestions. One, open dialogue, study and debate on the history and current status of specialized legislation, its advantages for whom, its disadvantages for whom. Why is it supported? Why isn't it supported? And point two, pluralism rather than monism of approaches. Postmodern marriages of multiple disciplines to inform and enact meaningful social change while not sacrificing those in need while change takes place. So that's what Stephen and Liz had to say. Would you like to start by reacting to each other's remarks or those of the Gilson DePoys? Anybody have any comments before we move on to questions, comments? You want a microphone?
Yeah.
Or you could use that one. Do you want to use that one?
Can
you
reach it? I can't reach it. But...
Okay.
I'm not sure where to start. I love what everyone had to say. I feel like we have so much material, so thank you. I guess I wanted to ask Hillary a question first. It very much resonates with what you're saying about not segmenting parts of ourselves, for example, about on a personal level and certainly on a professional level. And I think as far as kind of talking about disability rights or disability justice that some are starting to say as part of a larger social justice movement, you know, it makes a lot of sense to me. I think I talked a little bit about that, but I feel like I often hear a lot of pushback from folks in the mainstream disability rights movement that say, well, you know, we have to stay on person. We've gotten so much from Republicans. You know, it was the first push that passed the ADA, it was the second that, or the signed the ADA, the second that signed the ADA Amendments Act. Sort of this fear of allying ourselves too closely with the left because then we may lose allies, and this sense of people with disabilities coming from every background and every political persuasion, so we really want to represent our whole community that we can't kind of go too far left. I'm wondering your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. I think I would first start out my response by saying that I am not 100% convinced that the arm of social justice movement as a whole is right. I think it's made up as a non-immigrant people from a non-immigrant places in the really hard so that I could be who I am today. And so in some sense, that special legislation and looking the Republicans and Democrats and, you know, anyone, was really beneficial because I am a result of that effort. but I do think politics change, and I think we are starting to see an emergence on the right, a very sort of different conservative anti-spending message, and I think that message is inherently anti-human rights. And so now I really want everyone, no matter what political ideology they come from, to have a place in the movement. I would also just mention that a lot of the policies that the right is mounted is not only anti-disability, but anti-human rights.
Any other inter-panel commentary?
Well, I certainly agree that there's unanimous agreement that I think specialized legislation and approaches such as that, you know, are potentially marginalizing and segregating, and, you know, I think one could say that the Americans with Disabilities Act, in some ways, has revealed, or some people would say, has revealed how that can actually, as Liz and Stephen said, it hasn't really increased access, but some people would even say that it's been detrimental to access when they look at how the employment rates of people with disabilities post the ADA, you know, have declined, and some people would like to attribute that to the ADA itself. So, but on the other hand, I'd have to say that I guess there are certainly instances in which there are specific problems that need a specific solution, and if that problem is one that is more specifically around an issue in disability, that sometimes those approaches may be the only way to get anything done. But in general, you know, I think we should be moving away from those and moving towards a inclusive kind of social justice that works for people with disabilities. And I don't need to talk about that. I mean, you heard Cornel West. He can explain that much better than I can. But you know, justice for all.
How do we?
Well, actually, Steve Lovett, since I need to leave, could I pose?
Yeah.
I apologize again because I do have actually a paper to present on access and use of healthcare services related to working age people with disabilities, so a disability related paper. I'm not going to be able to kind of stay for the discussion, but I was very intrigued by some of the kind of comments that have been made in terms of how we move forward. I think because I teach at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and I do a lot of work related to long-term care specific to Medicaid. Because I teach politics and health, we follow the election very closely. I know, and we all know, kind of the change, particularly at state levels, in terms of the governors that are in charge of state houses now, and in kind of the short term, despite what was brought to us by the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act in terms of the Medicaid Community First Choice option, expanded flexibility, all sorts of great things there. In the short run, many, many, many states and their governors have vowed to reduce spending, obviously because Medicaid and long-term care is a big piece of that. That's going to be a target. So kind of thinking, at least in the kind of the short to the near term and based on some of the discussion, what some of the thoughts are about kind of how to move forward to kind of at least preserve and perhaps expand, you know, what's available to people, and to kind of reflect on that, because it was mentioned, at least by Hillary, in the context not only of people with disabilities, but kind of more broadly in terms of collaborations that we might have with other groups. So I just raise that as a question. Thanks.
Yeah, I think that would be really sad things about the kind of the system that's been specifically talking about Medicaid in wiping out the way the system looks and the money that's available. It inherently pits different groups against one another. And as we start to talk about budget cuts and things like that, you know, everyone is fighting for their own piece, and no one wants to give up their own piece. And so that's a really good question, and it's a really tough question. I personally think that our greatest hope in hanging on to the things that we need is to band together with other communities and fight over one, one for one, so to speak. I know that that is far easier said than done. Because when it comes down to it, and a governor or a state legislature says, I'm taking X amount of money from Medicaid and giving it to, you know, another program that is equally in need, people forget that they have come together to fight together in the first place. And I really, really believe that the best way to preserve the things we need is to fight across communities.
I would definitely agree. Yeah. And I'm actually proud to say, I think in California, we sort of see a success story of that happening, of a way groups getting pitted against each other. And I have to say, I'm still sort of in this state of shock that we haven't come against each other. I think we, you know, we formed this very broad coalition.
Thank you. Yeah. No, I just wanted to
thank you. Thank you. So we formed this coalition of disability groups and seniors and health advocates and childcare and other low-income groups. And we have a lot of people that weren't necessarily used to working together. And I think we just knew that we were about to get pitted against each other if we didn't do something different. And I think it was also the coalition recognizing that it was really about power. It was about our power as grassroots organizations, as people, as individuals, to really get out there. And I think that's how we kind of fought in the past. And, you know, in a way right now in California, I think we're all a little bit stumped, sort of, you know, we've done everything we can think of, and what do we do now to prevent things getting even worse? Nobody really knows what to expect to Jerry Brown in California, which we think is good news, but you know, compared to the alternative, but we don't really know what it's going to mean for, you know, particularly for personal assistance services, but for all kinds of things. But I mean, I think what we did see was when we had dozens of people with disabilities and all of these other groups, other supporters, going out into the streets and walking the street and spending hours out there and getting arrested, that was probably one of the most noticeable actions. And the feedback from people inside the Capitol was that that's partly why they're saying, okay, we're not going to vote against interim supportive services. And again, we're all sort of, you know, amazed pleasantly that that worked. But I think we have to keep finding ways of doing that. And it's so easy for us to get tired as a community. And I think particularly the paternalism is still there to say, well, you know, we're not going to be able to get these numbers of people with disabilities out in the streets. Or, you know, particularly if we're handling with seniors, we're not going to be able to get seniors out. You know, they're not physically able to do that. And so we have all these challenges to fight against, but I think if we can keep getting huge numbers out, that's something we have to keep from, I'd like to say to keep winning, but, you know, right now you have to say to keep from losing.
Go ahead.
I just want to add on that that with respect to the Community Choice Act, that was a strong coalition from the disability community, really, you know, consortium of citizens with disabilities, ADAPT. Nobody was really left out. I'm not sure how much the intellectual and developmental disability community was. They were a supporter in part. It's, they have some of the Medicaid money, and so some people look at that group and say, wow, they've gotten a lot out of Medicaid, you know, seniors are getting screwed. So there's some of that in the context of the discussion, but, you know, the Community Choice Act was a strong disability community alliance with the aging community, and that really made a difference.
I was just going to ask for a couple comments or questions from the audience. Anybody raise their hand?
Nancy, we're short microphones, so.
This is Nancy Munger from Syracuse University. I think I fall somewhere between the different positions that have been articulated between Steve and Liz and Absentia and Hillary and Mitch. But what's been bothering me is that we have managed to sort of, I think, perpetuate this medical model thinking by having the healthcare legislation be the primary vehicle for the things you were talking about, Mitch, the sort of, you know, so if you want to go to a Giants game, why is your health plan paying for it?
Exactly.
And so, well, I guess I'm not in the get rid of all specialized disability legislation camp, because I really think there's been evidence of real power by drawing together and by focusing. I'd like to see sort of breaking out of the mold of it all being lodged in the healthcare legislation and why it isn't in other forms. I mean, to some extent the ADA is, you know, broader than just healthcare, but still the main funding vehicle is health, and I think that keeps us locked in ways that don't broaden the view and keep then disability as primarily a medical thing and not a rights issue.
I mean, in this is part of the it's part of the same argument of you know, we need to make, well, Mitch was saying we need to make cost-effectiveness arguments, even though, I mean, I do cost-effectiveness work, and yet I agree it shouldn't be about cost-effectiveness, it should be about doing the right thing, which is essentially what, it should be about human rights, which is what Mitch said. I mean, we're talking about, you know, rather broad things, and then we've already come back to, well, we have to fight for the, you know, for not losing the money. I mean, how do we, I mean, the only reason it's tacked onto healthcare legislation is that's where how we can get it, right? Go ahead.
Well, if you read the healthcare reform bill, you will see, I think it's after the section on the community first choice option, a little paragraph about the sentiment of the Senate. And the sentiment of the Senate, as stated in the bill, is kind of like, well, this isn't, here's some stuff, but it's not really enough. So next term, we want to do comprehensive long-term care reform. Well, obviously, you know, that's not going to happen. But you know, in California, the in-home services and the in-home supportive services program was originally a state program. And it was basically built by the leaders in the disability movement, you know, independent living gurus, Ed Roberts, Judy Heumann, and their contributions and other people's contributions. But then, you know, because it became a money issue, it got folded into Medicaid. So basically that program, which was an independent living program, became under healthcare and became, in a way, somewhat medicalized. So, no, I really agree with your perspective on that. This shouldn't be healthcare. This should be civil rights. And so, You got where the money is, I guess.
Are you two okay using that microphone?
I very much appreciate your point. This is on. I agree, and unfortunately, I don't have, we should do it this way instead of through healthcare. Although it's funny, I find myself somehow mellowing out about some things as I do this work longer, which I can't decide if it's good or bad. But this is one thing where I feel like, well, I see places where maybe it doesn't matter. In California, supportive services is part of Medicaid, but most people who use it don't know that, or a lot of people don't know that, and in that sense, just as well. And of course, there's ways that their medical model is still going to sit in there, but if we can find ways to keep it separate, and to some extent we do that, and that's wonderful. And I'm thinking of someone going to the Giants game, where most people learn about personal, maybe it's not most people, but I'm thinking a lot of people learn about personal assistance services when they see someone at the Giants game, and they say, oh, this is my attendance, my whatever they're going to call them. And so even though that person may be paid for through a healthcare model, they're seeing them at the Giants game, they're seeing them at the grocery store. And as long as people are getting out in the community, it doesn't matter how we pay for it, it matters that it's there and that people are out.
Then I had one topic and then I listened to Anthony talk and I feel like I have something to say for today. Melissa, I think you hit the nail right on the head. The medicine model is a problem. And much of the policy historically has come from the medical model, which in my mind is a problem. That being said, I think that you agree with Jessica to a certain extent that it doesn't matter. See, I'm thinking as I'm sitting here. It doesn't matter where the money comes. I guess this is not giving how much. For everyday people living their lives, it doesn't matter where the money comes from. But from an ideological movement perspective, it very much matters where the money is coming from. Mm-hmm. And so we have this tension between individual people just trying to live their lives and this ideological academic idea of the medical model and the disability policy. And I think that's a tension that I personally have not resolved for myself. I don't practice law anymore, but when I was practicing law, I had clients that, any law that was available to me, even, special legislation, I used because it was going to make that person's life better. But now, when I'm on the policy side of things, I'm not sure that's such a good idea. So I think you've identified a very real tension, but unfortunately I don't have any good answer.
I think this is a really fascinating discussion, and I'm probably going to voice one opinion now and then have poor stability and you could get something from me later. But ideally, when I think about housing, personal care assistance, and community first option kinds of dollars closer to traditional medical dollars, it helps us to maybe understand that there's cost shifting when we don't do one well. Some of the work that we've done in terms of stability and personal care assistance and its relationship to health outcomes for people with disabilities, I think is relevant in terms of when we don't do it well, then we're paying it through state Medicaid plans for pressure sores, for UTIs, for dehydration, for bowel impaction, and all these things that are very important to people with disabilities. So to the extent to which public health won in getting prevention and wellness into the Health Care Reform Act, to me, I see community first option as wellness for people with disabilities, consumer controls, and options for where you want to live and what you want to do, and quality personal assistance. So that's ideally, and maybe it helps us to broaden our perspective of health by broadening the strategies by which people maintain health and wellness. So that's just my thoughts.
How do we, let me ask the panel. So we've talked about a lot of problems. I wanted to go back to, you know, Jessica started off with genetic counseling and genetic testing. There's clearly a great deal of attitude left to be changed 20 years after the ADA. I mean, yesterday I was reading an article in the paper about some new drug that's going to be tested and it's going to cure the terrible scourge of autism. And the language in the article wasn't quite that bad, but it was almost that bad. And I'm thinking, okay, we have one autism self-advocate at the conference this year, I'm very pleased to see. We had a different one last year. They'd be horrified to think about they're being cured or to think that they're not healthy. That was exactly the word used in the article. So that's a big attitude shift that we need. An attitude shift to between from cost effectiveness to doing the right thing is another one. I mean, there's lots left to do, and it's somehow, looking at it from that perspective, it seems like maybe we haven't gone that far after all. Respond.
Steve, I'm sorry, I can't keep my mouth shut.
Oh, there you are.
I have a 47-year perspective on this, okay? My experience is 47 years old. When my son was born, okay, people with mental retardation, excuse me, that was the terminology, I know it's intellectual disability now, did not go to school, they went into institutions, okay? And I have had the experience of following policy changes that allowed us to keep him home with us until he was transitional age 20. He went to school. Okay? He, by the way, he's severely profoundly retarded, so it's not like he didn't stand out dramatically in the context of the local neighborhood. And then he was institutionalized for a short time because of my own health. But at that point there was the deinstitutionalization process, and so he's out and he's in a group home. This relatively young man, has a really good life experience. He wouldn't have had that 100 years ago, and he's fortunate to live right when he has lived. And I think the policy proposals or the policy approaches aren't perfect, but I think if you look at the big picture, there has been tremendous progress made. And maybe the ADA isn't all we wanted it to be, and maybe we are still too dependent on, and I agree with Nancy, that we're still too dependent on the medical perspective, but in my own lifetime and in my own experience, we've made huge changes. And I don't know how in any culture there was a whole lot more that you can do. Certainly other cultures haven't approached our success.
Yeah, I mean, I actually had the discussion with Stephen and Liz, you know, when they basically say, well, you know, these policy approaches have failed. And I said, well, certainly there are people who are employed now who wouldn't have been employed had there been no ADA. And the answer was, well, how do you know that? How do you know that some other approach wouldn't have worked better? On the other hand, you know, Hillary said, I mean, she would probably not be the success she is now had it not been for those laws. I doubt Jessica would have been able to go to Stanford had it not been accessible. You know, so are we making a mistake by not giving all these policies their due credit? Do you need?
I would definitely agree. I mean, I think 20 years after the ADA, we have to be really honest that yes, we have a ton of work ahead of us, and there's just so much to be done. Obviously, we're not anywhere near where we want to be, but at the same time, we have done a lot, and I think Hillary said it really well in terms of being really grateful for all of the disability rights leaders that came before us and all the work that was done. Yeah, I mean, I very, very much feel the same way that I've benefited incredibly from all of the laws and from the work the community has done to shift attitudes to some extent. You know, obviously I deal with stigma and discrimination all the time, but still that I'm able to live a very full life, that I'm able to get to know people all the time who have experiences of disability and who can start to understand it in ways that so many people couldn't 50 years ago. I think that says a lot. I also think on this point, you know, as far as kind of what have the laws gotten us and how much are we separating disability, that I think we also have to recognize the value of separating disability and building the disability community. That I was lucky when I was 18, 19 to start to understand that I was part of this community and to start to learn about disability pride, to really take on an identity as a person with a disability, along with many other identities, as Hillary talked about. And I think that's a relatively new thing, that youth are growing up now, certainly not all of them, but a lot of kids and youth with disabilities growing up understanding that they have something to be proud of, and seeing people around them who have all kinds of disabilities, seeing the overlap, understanding that they have rights, that, you know, obviously they still have to keep fighting, but that there are things that they can lean on for support, there are people they can go to. And it's not necessarily concrete. It's not necessarily something that is going to say, okay, because I have this, I can do this. But I think it's really changing the shape of our community and what we can do from here.
Here. Well, which one works? Is either one work?
I don't know.
But they work, but they work for you. Or should we get the...
Because of the developed case law, now it actually exists. And so I do think there's a lot of windows. I do think we need to implement a system using this data. And it's not just in the memo. The discussion that I'm not needed to.
In terms of what Barbara had to say about progress, I think we have made quite a lot of progress. And I like to talk about three ways of deinstitutionalization, the first being the deinstitutionalization of people with mental illness, the second being people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and the third being people who are old or at risk of being in nursing homes. And there's just more progress to be made. And you know, we need to make sure that older people, you know, aren't shunted into nursing homes and have the means of spending as much time as possible in their own homes. And I say that in memory of my father, who had that opportunity, and for many other people. So, you know, and there's no right to any of this. I mean, you know, and we do have to make sure that what people have is not taken away. And so we still have to push for that.
Yeah, I think Alice had a question.
Actually more comments. I want to bring also the progress that we have made here in the American Public Health Association conference. Several years ago, the conference was in Chicago. And for those of you who were there, remember that there was a major issue with going from one hotel to another hotel, with transportation that was not accessible. And there were so many issues that finally Glenn White took the initiative to sue the American Public Health Association. As a result, we have now always one wonderful location in the main area to reduce transportation. So I think we have made really progress. However, I think there's a huge amount of more work to be done. APHA, the organization, is still in a culture of health and medical model, and they need to be aware of inclusion issues, that movies have captioning, that the signage is accessible for everybody, that people with disabilities are included in the leadership. I haven't seen a lot of people at the higher level of APHA who have visible disabilities, and I'm sure there are a lot of other examples, but I just wanted to share this with you.
This is going to sound contrary to the human rights argument that has been so eloquently articulated today, so you'll excuse me. I have one foot in the healthcare industry and another foot in the disability community, and so I try to take the arguments from whichever one of those worlds will advance the cause of the disability community. And in this political climate, given what we're looking forward to in the next 2 years, rather than trying to advance the human rights argument or even the personal attendant services as the backbone, it may be that using the healthcare argument on quality and cost could be used to help advance the cause, the movement. And that is, in the healthcare world, what they understand, even though you're stuck in a world where you say you don't want to be, and I understand that, but that world does not understand what PAS stands for, what long-term services and supports are, what home and community-based services are. If you go talk to the doctors and the hospitals who run up all of the costs in healthcare, they don't know, they don't understand the mechanisms of this world. If you wanted to grab their attention, you could do so by showing the added cost of things like UTIs and valve impaction, pressure sores, as a healthcare cost and quality wanted to offer that up for your consideration.
All right, why don't you do this next?
My previous comment about there's weird tension between advancing the ideology of the movement and also making sure that people have what they need to live and, you know, be independent, happy human beings. And I think it sort of speaks to this final argument of, does the end justify the means? And, you know, I'm not sure that any one of us on this panel necessarily have the right to be the arbitrator of the decision about that question, but I think it's a really important ongoing conversation for our community to have.
I was just happy in California that I didn't have to show what the costs of contractors and, weight loss and hospitalizations were, but it was sufficient within the legal system just to bring up the fact that these things are a risk that is highly likely if people have their services reduced. So, you know, I think that the cost-effectiveness argument can still be done and can be done better. We have to include those things in it. We have to include the cost of someone being denied education because they lack PAS and how to cost that, which is huge. I mean, if you didn't get to go to school because you needed an attendant, you lost a career. So that's not, my economist colleague Dorothy Rice calls that the indirect cost of foregone productivity. Well, that's really the indirect cost of a lifetime career. That's huge. And, you know, so I think, yes, I'm not saying that we can't do more with cost effectiveness, and especially in this environment. But, you know, I'd just like at some point for us to be able to look at it from a civil rights point of view, especially long-term services and supports, and think about some different ways of just allowing people to, I mean, you can just pay people more money, for example. A lot of these problems would go away if people with disabilities or people in general had an adequate income. They could buy these services. So there are different ways to approach this that we need to consider.
Why don't we move on to the next question? We don't have that much time left. Go ahead.
You brought up the point, or started to raise the issue in terms of the role of the media and the fact that we all, I think, agree that you can't legislate attitude.
Yeah.
I guess my question to the panel is, how can we as a community, working towards disability justice rights, whatever we want to call it, how can we do a better job engaging mainstream American population in being a voice for disability rights? Because the fact of the matter is that until we get accurate depiction of disability in the media, until we have a more general population buy-in to the value of the inclusion of people with disabilities in society, we're not going to see mass change, because that's who's in the legislature, that's who's in control and in power. So thinking outside the box of policy, what can we do better as a community to engage mainstream society in perpetuating our agenda?
I think there's actually a ton to be done, and my first thoughts are somewhat simplistic, so I'm just going to throw them out and I'll let the other panelists respond. So just at lunch today, preparing for the panel, I was with some friends, and I was sort of joking that I feel like with friends and family, that I sort of have this, maybe I shouldn't say I have, but that there's kind of this circle of new disability advocates out there right now, people that have gotten to know me, and then know your stories of kind of the things that they do, right, where they call a restaurant and say, are you wheelchair accessible? You know, and where they can do that whether or not I'm coming, as a way to kind of remind the restaurant that they should be thinking about it. Or where they see a news article, or they see a or to send out an article about here's why the disability community prefers this word instead of that. Those are kind of the first things that jump to mind. I think also for those that are in, you know, any kind of disability rights or social justice circles, this is partly it makes it easy to bring up disability because it's just so often simply not mentioned. It's just sometimes saying, and what about people with disabilities? Or, you know, okay, we may be looking at people with physical disabilities, but what about people with sensory disabilities or mental health or intellectual disabilities? That so often bringing up those things and continuing to bring it up and not dropping it until people with disabilities are brought into the table, are brought into the conversation in a lot of ways. That I think those are some very basic things that any of us can do.
Yeah, I don't have a lot to add to that. I would like to say, I mean, I think for a lot of us, just the act of living is monitored, and taking part in society is monitored. I would just say that I made a very conscious decision not to go and look for a disability-specific rights organization. I made a very conscious decision to go and look for an organization that does a lot of many members of social justice things, but disability is not one of the programs. Because I think just by me being there, it's a reminder that disability exists, and it's not going away, and you need to learn how to become disability friendly. And then I realized that, you know, not everyone has that opportunity, and but I think just living sometimes is the best way to sort of start to, you know, a way of awareness among people without disabilities. And I think the more we can be involved in society and take part in society and have access to the things that everyone else has access to, the more awareness there is.
There's nothing better than exposing people who hold stigmatory views to the people that they hold those views to correct that. And so I agree. I mean, it's the more people with disabilities are not segregated, but are, you know, out doing things just like anyone else's, then the less disability really has to be an issue. And the more people are exposed to people with disabilities who are doing that. I mean, I going around the conference, I see people using assistive technology, and I say, gee, I haven't seen her around the disability section, and kind of feel like, you know, we're missing something. But on the other hand, I conclude that, well, this is a person with a disability who's just going about the convention. And I kind of take some delight in seeing that.
Let's do one last comment or question from the audience. Where's Vanna with the, to get the microphone? Sorry, where's Meg with the microphone?
One other thing that I would sort of point to is, to the extent that we have PhD level studies, you know, focused on disability. That's tremendously encouraging. So, you know, as to the previous point, is the glass sort of half empty or half full? I'd say there's good evidence that we have made progress. I also think it is instructive, just thinking back in my own life, when I was first hurt, a friend of the family basically said, well, people in wheelchairs don't work, you know, he's just gonna stay home, you know, with you, Mom, from now on. And now, today, when people will meet me for the first time, the first question that I tend to get is, what do you do for your living? And boy, what a change that is. Mm. We have made attitude progress if you take the longer view. And as for the policy piece, I feel like there is a both and where we need to be able to understand that access to medical care and health care for people with disabilities is an incredibly important issue. But at the same time, the idea that we can fit all of our policy in under the banner of medical care, that's problematic too. So these things need to be in some kind of balance, I think is where I would be. Anyway, thanks for going to vote.
Does anybody on the panel want to have a last word?
I just want to thank everyone for really thought-provoking questions and comments, and I hope we can all continue this conversation more in a lot of different venues.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me and for engaging in the conversation. I know there's a lot of really tough things in the wrestling thing right now, and I think it's just really, really important to stay engaged in the conversation. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks. It's been an honor to be on this panel and also to receive your questions ideas.
Well, I thought this was a terrific panel. I don't know what everybody else did, but please indicate your approval by applause. Thank you all for coming.